We are buried and forgotten in thankless dead-end tasks. I did not suggest you leave. I suggested you have other opportunities. Kinsta's eyes narrowed with suspicion. If I can't leave, then... Correct me if I am wrong, but as an Inquisitor, you have access only to information about the case you are assigned to, whereas employees and administration have access to a wide variety of files. Kinsta gasped in horror with sudden understanding. You want me to spy on the Inquisitors? To betray? Betrayal is such an ugly word. Scarandum waved a claw dismissively. As a valued returning member of the Ethics and Compliance Office, you would be displaying loyalty by informing us of current and potential cases against the ECO, and against influential individuals who could be useful to the ECO if we advised them that they were a subject of official inquiry. I would be an ECO agent and an employee of the Inquisitors? Kinsta, do not talk nonsense. You would be employed only by the ECO. There simply is no need for you to inform the Inquisitors that you are no longer working for them, and since they won't be aware of your changed circumstances, they will continue to pay you, as would the ECO. Quite generously, Commander Kinsta. Commander? A promotion? That is... No, I can't do it. Of course you can. I would not have sold this idea to my leadership otherwise. Sold? Kinsta had to take deep breaths. When did you sell this idea? Oh, quite some time ago. When I first suspected my financial position was likely to be a serious problem and I needed a way out. Then Skippy, actually it was General Bishop's idea, approached me with the concept that I could get the Maxalks to bail me out, while of course screwing them in the process. Bishop suggested you lure me into... No, that was my idea. A bonus, you might say. Ruining my career is a bonus? Advancing your career? Kinsta, your talents are wasted with these clowns and special inquiries. Come home to the ECO. Ethics was never my home. Think of it this way, then. You won't be allowed to leave the Inquisitors, and they will make every day of your life miserable. Or you can endure that misery knowing you are screwing your tormentors every single moment you are there. I had prospects for a decent career here before you interfered.
Ha! Ha! Ha!
Scarandum laughed. Kinsta, you were recruited by the Inquisitors only because they loved the notion of employing a former ECO officer. They were never going to trust you. Can you think about it? As a favor to an old friend? I truly am trying to help you. If I am caught, you won't be caught, trust me. Kinsta simply stared at him. Scarandum coughed. Perhaps trust me wasn't the best thing to say at this moment, but I have never lied to you about anything important, that is. At any time, if you want out, we will simply fake your death. The Inquisitors will never believe I am dead unless they see and perform extensive testing on the corpse. Yes, and they will suspect the ECO was involved, and it will drive them absolutely insane with rage because they can't do anything about it. In spite of his anger and profound sense of betrayal, Kinsta smiled. It is nice to think of the Arbiter driven insane with rage. See? We should drink a toast to your new and assuredly prosperous career. Kinsta frowned at the bottle of Skipway Burgoos. Not with this, I hope. Hans Chotek waited until he was in his office to make the call. Waiting wasn't necessary, nor did he personally have to call. Such details ordinarily were handled by staff on both sides. He handled the matter himself to impress the other party that the United Nations Security Council was serious, and that he was making an effort to observe the proper diplomatic formalities. He was therefore caught off guard when the Ruhar ambassador immediately picked up the call himself.
Ah, Ambassador Chotek, this is an unexpected pleasure.
A slightly squeaky voice said in English, speaking without a translator device. It was known the Ruhar official also spoke Chinese and Spanish, but not Chotek's native German. Chotek, despite the call being voice only, blinked, paused a moment for thought, then relaxed in his chair. Hebert, he used the alien's first name. My call was not unexpected at all, was it?
No,
the Ruhar laughed.
I am surprised and pleased that you were chosen to approach us, Hans.
Do you know what we're asking?
We do, and the answer is yes. Could we discuss this at Wolfgang's in an hour?
That would be delightful. Hans had politely lied. His lunch that day would be anything but delightful. Despite the name, Wolfgang's did not serve German food, nor was it owned by anyone of Germanic heritage. It was owned by an ambitious Ruhr couple who had set up a boutique inn, bar, and restaurant in Geneva to cater initially to the Ruhr diplomatic military liaison staff, then to the increasing number of Ruhr coming to Earth seeking business opportunities. For the Ruhr patrons, the menu was supposedly authentic versions of Earth recipes, including the Wiener Schnitzel that had inspired the name, all made from imported food, since the aliens could not digest food from Earth. Human patrons, including Hans, were treated to Ruhr recipes made with food humans could digest. The lab-grown chicken and beef were not bad. The problem was that recipes popular with the Ruhr tasted simply weird, either bland or just bizarre. Boiled chicken and potatoes were at least edible, while the Ruhr dish called chicken volvesta was diced pieces of chicken and red bell peppers in a peppermint, chocolate, and jalapeno sauce that had even the most skilled human diplomats struggling not to offend their hosts by gagging. Thus, Hans Chotek had steeled himself to eat whatever was that day's chef's special when he sat down with Ambassador Hebert Relska in a private booth that was equipped with sound scrambling gear so their conversation could be somewhat private. At least the wine served to human guests was locally sourced, though he noted the wine list was, in his expert opinion, rather uninspired. Thank you. He raised a glass of serviceable Riesling, and Relska raised his own glass of whatever purple fizzy liquid the Ruhr enjoyed.
It is always a pleasure to see you again, Hans, and to have an excuse to dine at Wolfgang's on my expense card, of course, Relska laughed.
I wouldn't know anything about that, Hans winked. He sniffed the air as a waiter carried a covered tray past him to set down in front of a human guest who displayed a painfully rigid smile.
What is today's chef special? You do not want to know, Relska grinned, showing even more of his shiny white buck teeth than usual. For you, a human restaurant down the street is preparing a salad, then Austrian goulash, followed by something called, he looked up, searching his memory, Sachertort? Ah, here. He pointed toward the kitchen door where a waiter was carrying a plate and set it down in front of Hans, who was relieved. A peppercorn dressing, not any version of the Ruhr salad oils that tasted like toothpaste and soap.
Thank you, Hebert.
I will be enjoying this.
Relska sniffed his own salad, served hot in the usual Ruhr manner, and that did smell like toothpaste and soap.
Do you mind if I...
He gestured to the steaming salad with a fork.
Please, enjoy your food before it gets cold.
Hans took a forkful of what thankfully was regular locally sourced lettuce, cucumbers, and tomatoes.
My government, of course, has anticipated, since it was revealed the Moonraider is actually an entity from outside this galaxy, that your United Nations will wish a closer working relationship with my people. Further, we anticipated that your defense command would be seeking an opportunity to demonstrate the value of such an alliance, informal though it might be. It is understandable that such an opportunity should be a low-risk, high-visibility venture for your people, and that your DEFCOM is eager to move quickly.
You are well informed, Hans admitted.
Our communication security is as bad as we have been warned.
Bah! Relska waved a hand.
If my government has an ability to read your secure messages, they have not seen fit to pass down such information to me. Hans, everything I said is obvious to anyone who has been paying attention. You may tell the Security Council that we do have a joint military operation in mind that is not only low risk to you, it is also, I believe the expression your people use is, shovel ready?
Hans smiled. That expression applies to construction projects. Perhaps we should use the term boot ready, ready for us to land boots on an alien world. This opportunity, it is Hafustria? It was Relka's turn to smile.
You are remarkably well informed. Have you been reading our messages?
If my government can do that, they have not informed me. He finished the salad and pushed the plate aside, carefully setting the fork in the ceramic container that the Ruhar placed on each table for used utensils.
Hebert, your people requested assistance to take back Hafustria 3 years ago and have renewed that request regularly. It is not difficult to guess you still want that planet back.
We never should have lost it, Relska frowned, briefly hiding his incisors.
The loss of Hafustria was, at the time, a major scandal that nearly brought down the Ruhar coalition government. That isolated world was considered an unlikely target for invasion, being located on a dead-end wormhole having no strategic value, and as the star system was poor in metals, not suitable for industrial development. The major Kristang clans were still consolidating power and settling scores after their civil war, leaving no funds or energy for military adventures. The Maxalks were still licking their wounds from their own vicious civil war, with the victorious hegemony forces hunting down pockets of resistance. Those factors were why, when Hafustria's strategic defense network was due for an upgrade, the Ruhar central government decided to spend the money elsewhere, not only to delay the upgrades, but to decommission SD satellites that had reached the end of their service lives. With a largely agricultural population of only 17 million, the residents of Hafustria couldn't justify taking defense funds that were urgently needed by other, more important worlds. That was when the hegemony decided it was necessary to demonstrate their faltering coalition could still be dangerous and ordered the Theranin to support a Kristang fire dragon invasion of Hafustria backed up by a squadron of Maxalk's cruisers. The invasion was relatively peaceful as orbital assaults go, the lizards of the invasion force wary of being betrayed at any moment. The betrayal happened, of course. Only after 40,000 warriors of a minor subclan had been landed and their leaders realized the fire dragons had simply wanted to be rid of potential troublemakers. Since then, the invaders had received minimal support, the Theranin maintaining a single squadron of cruisers in orbit to keep their patrons satisfied. When the Ruhar had first approached the United Nations for assistance in kicking the lizards off Hafustria, that was after the Silver Claw subclan there had hinted they would not resist a counter-invasion, would in fact welcome an opportunity to go back home to civilization. To the DEFCOM Joint Chiefs, it did sound like an excellent opportunity to assist a potential ally. To their civilian governments, it sounded like another open-ended adventure paid for by tax dollars, and a weary population protected by invincible sentinels wanted to have no involvement with the troubles of aliens. The Silver Claws are still on board with surrendering peacefully? Hans took a sip of the Riesling.
Relatively peacefully, Relska gestured with a fork for emphasis. They are still Kristang, we must remember. Also, the offer comes from the local Silver Claw leadership. Their low-level warriors are less likely to welcome going back home to their clan in shame.
What about the Theranin?
Our intelligence indicates they will make a show of resistance, enough to avoid punishment by their benevolent patrons. Hans, all we require is a human show of force. Arrive with a handful of your wonderful battleships, an assault carrier or two, and my people will handle the rest.
It is easy for you or I to say that. We won't have our boots on the ground.
Relska snorted.
Your assault landing craft will be filled with your lapdogs, not humans.
Hans resisted the urge to tense up.
The Verdkris are not lapdogs.
My apologies. We both know your defense command has preferred to deploy Verdkris soldiers rather than risking the lives of human troops.
The Verds are still eager to prove themselves. Your people are missing an opportunity to form a valuable alliance with them.
Our memory of when the Verdkris rose up without warning and slaughtered Ruhar civilians is still fresh in our minds. Besides, the Ruhar ambassador shrugged, we seek an alliance with humanity and we get Verdkris as a bonus. Ah, your goulash is here.
The waiter set a covered dish in front of Hans, and when the cover was lifted away, the aroma made his mouth water. Several of the humans around him could not conceal their envy as they picked at the strange alien recipe they had been served. Hans saluted his host with a fork.
This is excellent. Thank you.
We are in agreement that you will present our plan to the Security Council?
We are.
Relska nodded happily and tapped his phone.
Our military liaison people will be available to discuss the details. We do have one suggestion.
Here it comes, Hans told himself. A suggestion or a requirement? We are sure our suggestion will be to our mutual benefit. Relska's smile was more practiced than genuine.
We would prefer General Perkins to lead your assault force.
Hans took a slow sip of wine. The last time she served in a Ruhar operation, it did not go well for the force she led. That memory is still fresh.
The Mavericks were sent into a death trap on Fesnico, most regrettably. Those responsible have been punished, as I'm sure General Perkins knows. If I may speak freely?
Please do.
We want Perkins to command the force in part because of what happened on Fesnico. To use a human expression, she gets shit done, regardless of the obstacles thrown across her path. We do not expect any surprises at Hephaestria. However, if there are any significant unpleasantries, we want the force to be commanded by someone who has demonstrated on many occasions that she will do whatever is necessary to secure the objective.
That, Hans admitted, certainly describes Perkins.
Your interest in her would not in any way be related to the fact that her husband's security company has the largest, best-equipped, most experienced, independent mercenary force in the galaxy.
Huh.
Relska paused, the fork halfway to his mouth.
That certainly could be an advantage. I should, he grinned, mention that to my government.
You should, Hans agreed. If this food were not so delicious, I might be tempted to call you on your bullshit. But,
he took another sip of what he had decided was actually a serviceable wine. Let's not spoil the moment.
Hephaestria is likely the best candidate for a joint operation. DEFCOM will want alternatives to consider, if only to give their overworked staff officers something to do.
Ah, Relska nodded.
Staff officers are underappreciated in all societies. I do just happen to have several other possibilities for joint operations. However, our military authorities have strongly advised me the alternatives would all be best as follow-ups to the successful retaking of Hephaestria.
You don't want us to get distracted by the shiny new toy and forget about what is important?
I did not say that.
The Ruhar set down his fork and clapped his hands.
We are in for a treat.
He pointed to a Ruhar woman who was walking toward the small stage at one end of the dining room.
This afternoon's entertainer will sing selections from our most popular operas. Oh, this is exciting.
Hans murmured something he thought was appropriate while tapping on the phone held in his lap. The icon he activated would reset the audio filter of the earpieces he wore, specifically to mute anyone singing in the Ruhar common language. The situation could be worse, he realized. He could be back aboard the Flying Dutchman listening to Skippy butcher songs during karaoke night. Chapter 7. The surprise was indeed already old when the UN Navy had captured it in an operation I wasn't involved in 8 years ago. The ship had been a token force guarding a Kristang world that the lizards had taken from the Ruhar, and when the hamsters decided they wanted it back, they made a deal with what at the time was still UNEF. Also at the time, the UN was looking to build alliances and a lot more willing to engage in what are called optional operations, meaning battles we didn't absolutely need to fight. Anyway, a star team infiltrated the ship and captured it, a triumph that was extra impressive since Skippy wasn't involved at all. Even for a frigate, the ship is small and is equipped only with relatively light weapons other than the usual launch tubes for ship-killer missiles. That design was developed by the Theranon to be a ship that could be constructed quickly, inexpensive, so it could be procured in large numbers and cheap to operate. Basically a design intended for non-essential peacetime tasks such as showing the flag at colony worlds of the Theranon's client species while being a good enough sensor platform to assist the fleet during times of war. I know, blah blah blah. Nerdy technical details of enemy weapons platforms are interesting to me because I'm in the military, but not everyone is into warship porn. The point is, Treydev was astonished when I requested that frigate to be transferred to Task Force Black. The captain of the Surprise was completely incredulous when I stepped out of a Panther dropship in one of the frigate's two docking bays.
General Bishop, welcome aboard, he said in a thick German accent.
Captain Kirke. I returned the salute, then,
Kirche. That's the German word for church?
Yes.
The guy's shoulders slumped just a bit. He must have known what I was going to say next.
Kirk is the Scottish word for church, so are you Captain Kirk?
I grinned.
That was my call sign in the Luftwaffe, yes.
One side of his mouth twitched. He was distinctly not smiling. I dropped the subject.
Admiral Becker told me that although this is a training ship, the Surprise is fully flight and combat ready.
That is correct.
His lips drew into a tight line. He had to be concerned that I had inquired about whether his little ship was ready for combat.
The Surprise was intended to be an asset available to Special Operations Forces if they ever need a Theranin ship for some...
He waved a hand.
Cowboy nonsense. General, may I ask why you need my ship?
For some Special Operations cowboy nonsense. That remark did not win me any points with Captain Kirke. Task Force Black consisted of the battleships Ohio, Normandy, and Fujian, with the battlecruiser Constellation and the frigate Surprise, all riding on the star carrier Rio Grande. While technically I had transferred my command to the battlecruiser, my cabin was aboard the Surprise with Skippy. The Constellation was a fine ship, the lead ship for the Block 4 expansion pack, the ship that worked the bugs out of those upgraded systems. Yes, the Connie was a fine ship. It just wasn't my Valkyrie. I missed Bilby and I missed Reed. Aboard the frigate, I missed pretty much everything, like being able to use a gym that was larger than a typically cramped cabin. Three of the frigate's cargo holds had been cleared out for use by the star team. If we had to be on extended independent duty, the ship would be running out of fresh food, but we would be attached to the star carrier for most of the trip. Frey's team spent the flight aboard the Rio Grande. The facilities there were better for training. And even before we stripped the frigate to drop weight, the Surprise wasn't the most comfortable ship in the UN Navy. After three frantic days of hard work removing everything we didn't need for our special mission, the little frigate was a lean, mean, fighting machine. Okay, the ship was lean, not so much the mean and fighting parts. The space dock crews had emptied the ship's missile magazines, even the armor plating around those now useless compartments. The Maser cannon exciters were torn out also. Those things are heavy, and we didn't need masers, or any other type of offensive weapon. The generators that project virtual magnets along a railgun are heavy, but fortunately that class of frigate didn't have a railgun, saving us the trouble of digging the thing out from the ship's spine. Both docking bays were empty, not only of dropships, but also of the usual stacks of spare parts and servicing equipment, even the cradles that hold spacecraft secure aboard the frigate. Where we were going, we didn't need drop ships. There was a lot of debate about whether to remove the frigate's armor plating, which really was only strong enough to protect the ship from shrapnel, not direct impacts. After much discussion and analysis, I made the decision to leave the armor intact, despite the major weight penalty. I could not risk a golden BB taking out a critical component, leading to loss of vehicle, crew, and mission. An unarmored ship was too vulnerable to a lucky enemy shot, or even a ricochet from our own weapons, so the light armor plating stayed. The defense shield generators were also torn out, except for the one on the ship's nose that would protect us from slamming into a grain of sand at 5 meters per second, punching through the entire ship and into the reactor. Why did we tear out the shield generators, leaving the ship almost defenseless? Where we were going, shields would indeed be useful. But we just wouldn't be able to activate them without instantly shorting out the entire array, so most of them had to go. Basically, anything under the frigate's armor that wasn't needed for that specific mission was removed. Once the ship was as light as possible, we started adding specialized components needed for our special mission. That added weight back, but not permanently. The advanced stealth field generators wouldn't fit inside the hull, so they were designed as three rings that would wrap around the ship, and the attachment points had explosive bolts. We would be discarding the stealth rings before we took the ship into action, so the weight penalty didn't matter. The new 4-booster motors that were strapped to the ass end of the ship? Those would be coming with us on the way into action, but not the way out. Hopefully. That was the plan, anyway. So, that was the ship we needed for the mission. I also needed a crew. The Surprise's commanding officer wasn't a bad guy. Kirke was an excellent captain, capable, precise, and reliable. He was not a special operator, and the mission needed an experienced crew of specialists. So, I had contacted an old friend. Colonel Chen, one of Valkyrie's former pilots, who is now in charge of flight training for UN Special Operations Command. Fortunately for me, she and several of her team had completed their annual refresher training aboard the Surprise less than 3 months ago, so they knew the basics of how to fly the ship. "What do you think?" I asked her, as we viewed a schematic of the ship in the frigate's cramped wardroom. Chen had an expression where she scrunched up one side of her mouth when she was unhappy about something. I had seen that look a lot aboard Valkyrie, and I saw it again. "No one has any experience handling ship like," she waved a hand at the schematic. "This. The center of mass is completely different. The ship will be heavy at the tail, and I suspect it will fly like a pig. Will we get an opportunity to test this?" Her mouth scrunched up again while she thought of a tactful way to speak her mind. "Interesting setup?" "Yes." "Good. Then in a simulator." "Sir, you understand that is not good." Skippy programmed the simulator and gave me a solid shmaybe that it will duplicate the response of the real ship within 93% accuracy. "Is that a Skippy 93% or a real 93?" "Officially, I don't know what you're talking about. So, give me your thoughts." "Can I consider this for a bit?" "Of course." "My initial reaction is this is insane." "I wouldn't say that it." "On the positive side of the ledger, the insane plans of the pirates produced the best results. There is truly no other way to do this? Not forgetting access to the info we need. The Maxalks might not have any useful information about the outsider, but they are our best source right now." She shook her head. "The Kristang, then the Theranin, then the Maxalks, then a Sentinel, then a hostile Elder AI, and then Elders themselves. Now we are fighting a threat from beyond the galaxy. When does this end, sir?" "I thought it really was over until someone tried to carjack a Sentinel, so your guess is as good as mine." "You'll do it?" She shrugged. "We train with the Surprise once a year in case we ever need to use a Theranin ship as a disguise. But, sir, we honestly treated that week of training as almost a holiday. I never expected to take this bucket into action." "Out here, I know," she finished my thought. "The only thing you can expect is the unexpected." "Oh, what the hell? One last ride with the merry band of pirates?" "Let's not say this is the last of anything."
"Colonel Bonsu?"
Nagatha's soft voice in his ear interrupted his sleep. When he opened one eye, the cabin lights were gradually getting brighter.
"Ugh."
He slipped quietly out of the bed so he wouldn't disturb his sleeping wife, assuming the ship's AI had spoken only in his earpiece. Irene stirred and he froze until she went back to breathing evenly as he tapped the button to dim the lights. "A minute," he whispered, stepped quietly into the bathroom and closed the door. "What?"
"You might as well wake Colonel Strebik," Nagatha sighed. "Navy Assault Command is preparing orders for you. This is a heads up. We will be embarking 3 squadrons beginning tomorrow with a departure scheduled in 2 days.
"Departure?" That was news to Derek. The Flying Dutchman was in the Lagrange 3 parking area on the other side of Earth from the moon. That stable orbit was the low-rent district where the Navy kept ships in a reduced state of readiness. His wife was a commander air group without an air group. The Dutchman's docking bays held the only 2 dropships that were directly assigned to the assault carrier. His crew was 17 people under the authorized staffing level, including 2 vital engineering positions.
"Departure for where?"
"Hephaestria."
"Oh, not this shit again," he groaned.
3 times that he knew of, the Navy had begun preparations to support the hamsters taking back that colony world, and 3 times the operation went no further than bringing a few mothballed ships back into service. Since Moon Raider was revealed to be an outsider, the Navy had downgraded the required readiness of the entire assault command, and ships assigned to that command were given reduced priority for spare parts, access to maintenance services, and staffing. The Dutchman was, or had been, scheduled to transfer 23 crew to other ships within the next 2 days. Hopefully, he would instead be gaining personnel. Temporarily.
"So we are in hurry-up-and-wait mode?"
"Not this time, dear. The Security Council directed DEFCOM to—"
"Honey?"
Irene knocked on the bathroom door.
What's going on?
Derek slid the door open. We're embarking 3 squadrons for— Excuse me, Colonel Bonsu, Nagatha interrupted. General Perkins inquired whether you are awake.
We both are.
Irene stifled a yawn.
Connecting the call now.
Bonsu,
I...
Perkins yawned. Been a long night for you, General? Derek asked. Irene is here with me. Good. Strebik, you'll be embarking 3 squadrons, DAT 17 and 38 and DFA 41. Contact Colonel Banderas at Edwards to coordinate. Will do, ma'am. Irene tapped a note into her phone.
Where are we going?
Hafustria. Yes, we are finally doing it. I'm meeting with Admiral Koskinen in 15 minutes, so I'll make this short. The Navy is tasking 3 battleship groups. I don't know which ones yet. That doesn't matter. The Dutchman will be the only assault carrier. What we really need is a command ship, so you're up to bat on this one. I'm bringing the Mavericks with me, only the headquarters and service company. Derek blinked in surprise. A single company isn't much of a landing force, ma'am, wincing as he knew Perkins understood the obvious. Most of the boots on the ground will be Ruhar, Perkins explained. The UN leading this mission is to give the senior clan leaders on Hafustria cover to cooperate. Their warrior code wouldn't allow them to surrender to the Ruhar without a lot of blood on both sides. But if we show up with overwhelming firepower to chase the Theranin cover force away, no one could blame the Lizards for accepting the inevitable. Also, DEFCOM has contracted with Dave for 3 companies of Verdkris. We'll be stopping at Danslow to embark them. Will the Verds be bringing their supplies with them? The Dutchman isn't equipped to feed and provide medical care to Liz. He caught himself. To them, ma'am. Dave will have all that taken care of. You can guess the DEFCOM intends this to be a minimum risk op. If we get into trouble, we pull out. What if the Ruhar run into trouble once we're dirtside? Then we provide whatever support we can without risking our force. Bonsu, we'll have 3 battle wagons and their escorts upstairs, and the Lizards want to give up that rock. They do now, Derek argued. That could change in a hurry if their young warriors see an opportunity to hit the hamsters. That will be a problem for the Ruhar. I will be in overall command until the place is declared pacified and the Ruhar bring in a civilian authority to govern. The op plan calls for us to be on the ground no more than 7 weeks. Irene silently mouthed, "I have to go," to her husband, pointing at her phone. General, the Dutchman will be ready, Derek concluded. I know that. Admiral Clark's office will be contacting you to see what you need to bring the ship back up to combat readiness. Derek snorted. His office already has that list. I update it every morning. I'll get our VIP cabin sorted for you. Would you prefer chocolate or a mint on your pillow, ma'am? Perkins ended the call. Derek went back into the cabin where his wife was getting a uniform from the closet. We got woken up at 0200, he suppressed a yawn. And you look happy. What's that about?
DAT-17 is a UN Navy composite squadron. She held up her phone screen. Personnel from 7 countries.
We're all one big happy fleet, Derek nodded, not understanding. So?
So Dropship Attack Transport Squadron 38 and Dropship Fighter Attack 41 are U.S. Air Force all the way.
She tapped the American flag and U.S. Air Force patches on her uniform with pride. She and Derek had so far resisted the DEFCOM Blue to Black initiative, remaining in their home services, seconded to the UN Navy. Fewer than 36 UN Navy ships were commanded by Air Force or Army officers, and Irene was the only air group commander who hadn't transferred.
This might be the last time those squadrons deploy before they get absorbed into Big Navy.
The end of an era, Derek agreed.
Hit the shower, she waved him toward the bathroom, while I make a call. Honey?
Yes?
It's good to be going back into action again.
This is close enough, Joe, Skippy whispered after the Rio Grande jumped in a third of a light year from a star system that contained a planet the Maxalts had named Pentavar. In spite of tradition, we didn't bother giving the place another name. I hoped we wouldn't be there long enough to bother with a nickname. Technically, the planet was tagged Objective Rome, a name randomly assigned so it would be meaningless if the enemy intercepted our communications. We need to start assembling this Lego set.
The pieces are not Lego, Skippy.
Ah, whatevs. We need to start putting this Franken ship together.
I hope no one forgot any of the parts we need.
He was screwing with me. That wasn't a problem. He was also screwing with the frigate's crew, who weren't familiar with the asshole beer can. Chen did know Skippy, so she ignored his bullshit.
General, should we request the Rio Grande to release us from the docking platform?
We are, she pointed to her pilot console,
ready in all respects for flight.
Surprise drifted free of the Star Carrier and flew far enough away that the maintenance drones buzzing around our frigate didn't interfere with the Rio Grande's flight operations. The big battle wagons also detached from their hardpoints, so they would be ready to respond to any unexpected guests. That was unlikely at such a distance from the Star, but we weren't taking any chances. If we did get attacked by a Maxulk's task force, Surprise would be especially vulnerable. That was why Skippy and I were aboard Constellation, while he directed the bots and human engineering teams who were working to install the big stealth field projector rings around the frigate. That job took 17 hours, then testing and adjusting and testing again ate up another 9 hours. Finally, Surprise jumped away, jumped back, and we tested whether the disruption of jumping through a rip in spacetime had affected the stealth projectors. Skippy was satisfied with the results.
We are good to go, Joe, he announced.
You're sure about this?
I said we're good, dum-dum.
It's just that you will be aboard Surprise when we go into action, and if the stealth field fails, you will be in a ship with armor the thickness of tinfoil, exposed to the planetary SD network.
You know what, Joe? I shouldn't hog all the glory. You should go. I'll sit this one out.
You? I picked up the foam cradle his canister was settled into.
Are coming with me.
Surprise jumped in 4 light minutes from the Maxulk's planet Pentavar, close enough to confirm that an enemy transport ship was still where we expected it to be. It was just hanging out in a low orbit, waiting for clearance to unload its cargo, and no other ships were detected. The planet had a strategic defense network, a fairly modern system, and with the only important facility in the entire star system buried deep under the planet's surface, there wasn't any need for the expense of stationing warships there. Actually, a series of destroyers used to rotate in and out, one ship at a time, but that was before the kiddies got themselves into a nasty civil war that depleted the number of combat-ready ships. When the war slowly ground to a halt, the hegemony could only afford to deploy ships on taskings that were strictly necessary, and Pentavar didn't rate as a likely risk. So after Skippy gave the all-clear signal, we jumped again into orbit. Except we weren't actually moving at an orbital speed, and the jump was anything but ordinary. The mission called for our small, weak, lightweight training frigate to hang around the planet for a while in stealth, undetected. Getting close to the planet without the frigate's highly modified and highly unusual jump drive setting off alarms was one tricky part of a very tricky plan. The ship's drive didn't actually move the ship, not at first. It performed a maneuver Skippy and I had talked about years ago, back when I was still in command of Valkyrie. It had all been just theory since then, as we didn't have any need for such a complex operation. Until that day. The little frigate's jump drive actually had a hiccup. The initial jump stalled without enough power to pull the ship through. Instead, through the tiny pinhole of a wormhole shot one end of a micro wormhole, and we projected a stealth field bubble from that event horizon. Then the jump wormhole stabilized inside the bubble, increased power, and the ship emerged. The gamma rays of the jump were trapped inside the stealth field, bouncing around at the speed of light for a picosecond before Skippy created a gap in the stealth, allowing a directed burst of gamma radiation to race away from the planet above the plane of its orbit. In that direction, the closest enemy sensor platform was 87 light hours away, so we had a clock counting down to the kiddies possibly detecting us. With the ship comfortably wrapped in stealth, the Strategic Defense Network having no idea it had an uninvited visitor, and the transport ship waiting for clearance, we launched a drone to make a delivery. A very special delivery.
Chapter 8
Skippy, I held up my phone. The link you gave me to track the package isn't working. It says the package is in Memphis.
All packages get routed through Memphis, dum-dum.
Just put it on the main display, okay?
There is nothing to see, dum-dum. The package is in stealth.
Do it anyway, please.
Fine. Here it is.
I don't see anything.
That is the point of stealth, numbskull.
I know that My face had to be growing red from embarrassment.
Chen had served with me before, and she knew that Skippy insulted pretty much everyone. But the frigate's crew were giving each other quizzical looks. None of them would talk to their CO that way.
Okay, I get your point. Give me an update, please.
The stealth drone had approached the transport ship that was still lazily circling the planet, waiting for the cargo manifest to be reviewed and approved. Final approval for offloading was restricted to the archive administrator herself, and she was still asleep at the time. Her usual sleep cycle had been included in our plans. We needed the delay. Like I said, we had tracked the drone until it came within 800 kilometers of the transport ship, then Skippy had the thing go totally dark. At most sites we wanted to infiltrate, he could simply slowly hack into the strategic defense network and tell its sensor analysis processors to ignore any images or data that showed our ship, drones, or anything else we didn't want the enemy to be aware of. At Pentavar, he couldn't risk doing that. The sensors aboard satellites and on the ground fed their raw data not just to the SD network controller AI in orbit, but also to a backup system underground that was monitored independently by its own AI. Hacking into just one of the AIs would be useless. In fact, if the AI underground saw an anomaly the orbital system wasn't aware of, we might as well have set off a fireworks show in orbit that spelled, "Skippy is here!" So we didn't do that. Yes, Skippy could have hacked into both AIs, but that would have taken too long and required me to be within range of the SD network's weapons while he was aboard such a flimsy starship. I wasn't willing to accept that level of risk on an optional mission. Optional meaning we didn't absolutely have to get information from that data archive. We didn't know for certain the archive contained any info that might be useful to us. Without control of the SD sensors, we had to rely on stealth and do the job the old-fashioned way. That was more fun, anyway. Except when Skippy stopped updating the synthetic view on Surprise's main display, which was small enough that I had to lean forward and squint to see any detail.
"Show a schematic of where the thing is now."
"And..." Skippy held up a hand in dramatic fashion.
"Done. That's it. Delivery is complete."
"Complete?" The clock on the display showed we were 27 minutes ahead of schedule, if Skippy wasn't screwing with me. "Our drone has already docked with the transport ship, released the spider bot to slip inside through a maintenance access hatch, then that bot crawled all the way through the ship to the correct cargo bay where it inserted the package in a container, all without being detected by the ship's internal security system. I call bullshit on that."
"First," he huffed, "I docked that drone at the maintenance access hatch closest to the correct cargo bay because I am not a moron. I know exactly where the target containers are located, and I chose the fastest route. Second, that is a civilian transport ship. It doesn't have a real security system. I could have bypassed their pathetic security with a paperclip and a roll of duct tape."
"Assuming I believe you, why are you so ahead of schedule?"
"The schedule was padded to allow for delays if offloading was approved early, and I had to direct the spider bot to follow the target container while it was transferred to the aeroshell."
"Oh. Good thinking. Everything is cool, then?"
"If by cool, you mean the package is in place, the spider bot hid, then dissolved itself into dust, and the drone has detached and is now flying slowly away, all without the transport ship or the SD network having any idea they have an uninvited guest?"
"Yes, all that."
"Dunsky, you seem skeptical, Joe, so I will explain. All the things I did, by myself, by the way, would indeed be impossible for anyone else. However, I am Skippy the Magnificent.
Sorry, I failed to trust the awesomeness. It's been a while, okay? I'm out of practice. You are forgiven. This time. One question. You said the package is in place. What place? It can't just be in any random container. It has to be something that I know that, Joe. Don't worry about it. The packages are in a box of boo-boo cakes."
I blinked.
"A box of what?"
"Boo-boo cakes."
"Yeah, I heard that the first time. What is a boo-boo cake?"
"It's a snack food item."
"What does it sound like?"
"Okay, exactly why did you conceal the package in a box of snack food?
That is the sort of thing that is most likely to be opened by some sketchy logistics people or whoever signs for the box on the ground."
"That would be likely, except that, as I mentioned, I am not a moron. Boo-boo cakes originated on a remote Maxolk's colony planet that is generally considered a backwards shithole."
"Why do I care about that?"
The current director of the archives at Pentavar is from that backward shithole, and so are her two deputies. That box of boo-boo cakes are for them. No way would anyone open that box before it gets on the director's desk. Also, no one will dare to scan the box because the director is known to sometimes request certain other, less-than-legal substances in her shipment of boo-boo cakes. Oh, that was good thinking. It's me, so duh. We're good then? Nothing for us to do but wait? Correct, unless you dream up another monumentally stupid idea we could do instead. Nah, we stick to the plan. Chen cleared her throat. She blushed, embarrassed.
Is anyone else curious what a boo-boo cake tastes like?
I am, Frey agreed from behind us. Seriously? Skippy couldn't believe it. I'd like to know too, I admitted. Ugh, fine. How can I describe how those cakes would taste to a human? I guess... Let me create an interspecies flavor profile comparison matrix. This could take a while. It is a very complex... Done.
Interesting. It's a yellow cupcake with sort of a lemon flavoring. The filling is, I hate to say it, basically marshmallow fluff whipped into a light foam. On the outside is a frosting of vanilla and cinnamon.
Frey moaned.
That sounds amazing right now.
It does, I agreed. It's like a frosted Twinkie, only better. I want to try one.
It's just empty calories, Joe. Skippy rolled his eyes. Those are the best kind of calories. Empty calories don't make you put on weight. It's full calories that make you fat. I mean, that's just logic.
He hid his face behind a hand. I can't even. Okay. I held up my hands. New plan, everyone. Instead of raiding the archive here, I'm going to negotiate with the Maxalts for a boo-boo cake franchise.
Joe, Skippy sighed. When you talk, you make the whole galaxy dumber.
The box of delicious, nutritious boo-boo cakes, with the special package of our micro-wormhole event horizons and their stealth marble-sized containment vessels, did not get loaded into a Maxalts dropship for the flight down to Pentavar. Any spacecraft with people aboard had to land at a spaceport 80 kilometers away from the archive's access shaft, where passengers went through a very thorough scanning and decontamination process that took 7 hours. Cargo drops were accomplished by automated aeroshells that could only be used one time, reaching the surface on paraglider chutes. Cargo landed within 2 kilometers of the access shaft and was also subjected to random searches and scanning, though those rules were not rigidly followed. There wasn't any point to searching the cargo containers. They were carefully inspected and sealed at the origin. No one could have tampered with the containers in the secure holds of the transport ship. No one except an asshole beer can. As Skippy stated, no way was anyone on the ground going to question the director's personal shipment of luxury goods. The tiny stealth fields around the containment vessels, fields that were the toughest feature to build into the packages, were not even needed. We waited, slowly orbiting the planet while the transport ship was processed for clearance to descend into a low orbit. Once that ship started maneuvering, we did the same, and that was the most dangerous part of the entire mission. Chen had to get the Surprise into a geosynchronous orbit, which for that world normally would be at an altitude of 39,000 kilometers above the equator. Of course, it was not going to be that easy for us. The archive was 780 clicks below the surface, roughly halfway between the planet's equator and its north pole. By the time the box of snack cakes reached the archive chamber far beneath the surface of solid rock, Surprise had to be moving at the exact same speed and direction as that chamber, which was spinning around the center of the planet as the globe rotated. It was even more difficult than that to accomplish. We had to ensure the ship's nose and tail were oriented exactly straight up and down in relation to the planet's core and surface. There was some good news for us. The ship would not need to hold that position for long, only a few minutes after the package reached the chamber. Time for Skippy to verify the thing actually was there, that the position report wasn't just a glitch in the sensors. The time for the aeroshell to reach the surface after launch was predictable, as was the time for the elevator to descend from the surface to the archive chamber. The wild cards we couldn't control were the schedule for unloading the aeroshell and whether the box of boo-boo cakes would be on the first elevator trip or the last. I did not like being unable to control variables. The longer Surprise had to hang around Pentavar in an orbit close enough to be just beyond the SD network's sensor field, the greater the risk we would be detected. Finally, we saw the aeroshell launch, fire simple braking rockets, and begin its long, predictable ballistic arc down to the surface. Skippy, I forced myself to relax my hands, not clench them into fists. Everyone aboard the ship was keyed up. They didn't need to see their commander was anxious. Talk to me.
The capital of South Dakota is Pierre, not Sioux Falls, like most people assume.
What? Sturgis is the only other place in South Dakota most people have ever heard of because of the motorcycle rally there. Why are you telling me? You asked me to talk to you without suggesting a topic of conversation. I meant talk to me about our situation, you ass.
What about it? If anything was wrong, I will tell you.
I don't want just a simple check engine light that glows when something has already gone wrong. I need to know about potential issues as they develop or before they develop into problems we have to deal with. What is the status of our stealth field?
That information is on the display, dum-dum, he snapped. He was as irritated at me as I was at him. Numbers don't give me a feel for what's happening. If you open an airlock and stick your stupid monkey arm out into space, all you will feel is vacuum. Joe, what do you want from me?
This stealth field, the funky disposable generator rings. They're all your design. We have never used them before.
Correct, because those rings are wildly impractical for any warship. They are too big and clumsy. They would stick out beyond the defensive shields if we had those switched on, and they will burn out in 4 hours and 37 minutes.
But?
They are working fantastic, just as I hoped. The collectors are absorbing particles even more efficiently than I expected. Even at this reckless speed, we aren't leaving a detectable wake. That is the biggest risk we can't control.
The SD network sensors haven't noticed anything unusual?
No, everything is quiet.
Great. For now, I can't make any promises.
Understood.
Chen shifted in her seat. She didn't say anything, didn't give me a look. I got her message intended or not. She and her people were trying to maintain focus. My chit-chat with Skippy was a distraction. So I kept quiet and watched the display. The aeroshell had slowed down enough to deploy its paraglider chute and was turning into the wind to line up an approach to the landing field. Skippy's experimental stealth field was operating nominally. You might think the fact that our critical stealth field was an experiment might be a potentially huge problem. That wasn't quite true. The thing was constructed of standard proven components, just scaled way up. The stealth effect wrapped around surprise was larger than even the field of a star carrier, significantly larger across than any such field generated by a warship that Skippy knew of. Why did a frigate that was on the small side, even for such ships, need an especially large stealth blanket to envelop it? Because of the speed we needed to maintain, to keep geosynchronous pace with the archive chamber. There are three ways a stealth chip can be detected. At short ranges, the presence of an object passing through a sensor field could be detected, located, and tracked, whether the object itself was visible or not. Any object within a sensor field changed the expected shape of the field. There was no way to mask the effect. Okay, yes, Skippy had an ability to sort of bend a sensor field back into the expected shape around us, but that ability was limited, and at surprise's speed, he couldn't quite bend it fast enough. That is why we were just beyond the effective range of the SD network's sensor field around Pentavar. Another way a stealth ship could be detected is reflections of active sensor pulses. While extending a sensor field does not give away the position of the ship generating the field, sending out an active sensor pulse is like holding up a giant shoot me sign. An outgoing sensor pulse can be detected at a much longer range than a comparatively weak reflection. It is not unknown for a stealth ship to creep up close to a broadcasting ship and nail the sender with railguns before the broadcasting knucklehead even knows another ship is out there, which is why starships generally don't use active searches. A few of the orbiting SD network satellites did send out regular pulses, but the signal strength wasn't powerful enough to get a reflection off our Costco value pack-sized stealth field. So, we only had to be concerned about the third way stealth ships can be detected. The ripples of charged particles that moving ships leave in their wake. Space isn't empty, not even between stars. Close to a planet, a habitable world, and a star's Goldilocks zone, there is a solar wind, plus gases being stripped away from the upper atmosphere, and particles from accidental satellite collisions, debris from space battles, even stuff like tools lost in orbit by repair bots. My point is, surprise was flying through stuff, lots of stuff, and flying at high speed.
The SD network kept track of the environment around the planet, so if a bunch of particles that were going this way suddenly bounced off an unseen object and started traveling that way, the object was no longer actually unseen. Starships normally avoided being detected by flying slowly and by minimizing their frontal cross-section, meaning ships tend to be long and skinny, even though they don't need to be aerodynamic in space. Flying slowly is a trade-off. Ships in combat environments are constantly moving left, right, up, and down to throw off the aim of enemy line-of-sight weapons like directed energy and railguns. The faster a ship is flying, the farther a course change will move the ship in a given time. As with freighter aircraft, if you're slow, you're dead. I'm a pilot and a former starship captain, so nerdy details of basic space combat tactics are interesting to me. Maybe not so much to everyone. Surprise had to fly fast to keep pace with the archive chamber in an environment relatively thick with particles, so we had to actively prevent a trail of disturbed particles from forming in our wake. Skippy's solution to our unique problem was for the stealth field to act as a vacuum, which I know is an odd thing to say in the hard vacuum of space. The field absorbed particles that struck it, channeling those particles down into storage bottles placed at the bottom of the stealth field struts. Skippy constantly tracked in real time the particles in front of us, their composition, speed, and temperature. With him directly controlling the equipment, canisters near Surprise's stern sprayed out particles, since leaving an empty void behind us would be as unusual as leaving a stream of energetic particles an astronaut could wakeboard on. We had a time limit. The stealth field generators would burn out, and the storage bottles could hold only so many particles before they overheated and exploded. My anxiety wasn't about our ship. It was about the Maxalt's personnel on the ground. Those assholes could secure the aero shell, remove the parachute, and then decide to take a break to watch the semifinals of full contact ice dancing or some shit like that. It would be better if we could hurry the process along. Skippy, do you have access to the manifest of that aero shell? I asked, just after the shell set down in a puff of dust and the paraglider chute was released to go tumbling across the airfield. Of course. Why? Was the cargo in that aero shell combat loaded? That is a military term meaning you want guns and ammo at the front of a container, socks and other less critical stuff at the back. Not really. The archive is a government facility, not under the control of the hegemony military. Why? So there is no priority list for which cargo gets unloaded first? I didn't say that. There is such a priority ranking. The box of boo-boo cakes is near the bottom of that list. That's no good. It would be a shame if the director had to wait for a delicious snack from home, if yez knows what I mean. Well, that is a very good point. The box of boo-boo cakes is now tagged as the highest priority under the authority of the director's deputy. We have a bit of luck here. It is known the hegemony government is considered staffing reductions at all of their archives since their civil war is over. The personnel down there will not want to get the director pissed off at them. Outstanding. It is also lucky that the cargo manifest system has a very low level of security. Skippy, when you work a miracle, don't tell anyone how easy it actually was. Just take the win, okay? Oh, I need to write that down. Joe, I estimate the package will now be taking the trip down the elevator within 35 minutes. Add another 12 minutes for the elevator car to reach the chamber, so a total of 47 minutes. That's much better. Chen, can you get this clumsy bucket of bolts into position in that time?
Not a problem, sir.
She grinned. She was looking forward to the challenge.
We can get close, then fine-tune our position once the elevator starts dropping.
Frey, I called to the star team leader who wasn't on the bridge. You heard the update in timing?
Sooner is better, sir, she acknowledged. My team loses focus when they're bored.
The box of snack cakes was loaded into the elevator car, carefully placed on top of other containers so it wouldn't be damaged in transit. The car began its descent.
Places, everyone! He clapped his hands. We have 12 minutes to showtime, Skippy announced.
Pilot, bring us into sync with the chamber, Chen ordered.
To the entire crew, she spoke over the shipwide intercom.
All hands, we are now observing minimum motion protocol. Everyone strap in and try not to breathe too hard.
She was joking about that last part, but the situation was no joke.
Just like when Valkyrie had to hover over a precise spot on the surface of the Theranan planet Slithin so Skippy could launch one micro-wormhole after another to bore a hole down to a secure military base, the ship had to be an ultra-stable platform. The process at Slithin had been incredibly tedious for everyone aboard, especially for Skippy. We meat sacks had been able to relax in our cabins, watching movies or binging old TV shows. Skippy had to focus on guiding Bilby to keep the ship in an extremely precise position in the sky above Slithin, hour after nerve-wracking hour, while each micro-wormhole bored a tunnel just a little bit deeper. That tedium paid off. We had destroyed that secure underground base, with the Theranin still having no clue how we did it. At Pentavar, we couldn't use the same technique because our goal was not to destroy the Archive. We wanted to get a star team in there and steal the AI's core. How the hell could we do that? Well, sneaking a team into the elevator was not an option. We also couldn't jump a DeLorean dropship into the chamber. The internal defenses down there would shred even the toughest dropship we had. Yes, we had jumped a DeLorean dropship into an underground chamber before, like at the planet we called Detroit. That time, Skippy had directed a stealth missile to deliver a micro-wormhole into an unguarded cavern near the objective. At Pentavar, the active chamber was deep below solid rock, no way for a missile to fly in, or even a nanoscale bot to crawl down to the objective. So, we hid the micro-wormholes in a box of boo-boo cakes. The micro-wormholes would soon be in the archive chamber. Surprise would be in position high above the chamber in a direct line of sight, though we couldn't actually see the objective. There were still the chamber's internal defenses to deal with, and Skippy moped that even he couldn't hack into the archive's defense system from orbit, not through the low-bandwidth connection of a micro-wormhole. Skippy had told me the entire operation was impossible, until I had showed him how to do it. Skippy! I shouted over the din of the special jump drive capacitors loading up. This is the worst techno music ever. Oh, you're just saying that because you have no rhythm. This is actually a danceable beat. Does it have to be so loud? Passive sound insulation is heavy, Joe. You can suck it up for another few minutes, or we can add weight and the ship will fall and go boom. Just get it done as soon as you can, please. I gritted my teeth. As a father, I understood that within a few short years I would be yelling at my boys to turn down whatever awful music kids were listening to at that time. Skippy. I took a calming breath, though I was wary of breathing too hard. The techno music mercifully had stopped and my ears were still ringing. Tell us only if something has gone wrong and we need to abort the op. We do not need you to give us a running commentary. Good, because I am way too busy to babysit you right now, he snapped. Chen, I held up my hands. This is your show. She nodded, and the display counted down to zero, then the zero symbol turned green. That was the signal the micro-wormhole containment vessel was inside the archive chamber. Pilot, Chen didn't waste time, for more time hovering above the chamber was more time for something to go wrong. Initiate sequence to eject the stealth generators and punch it. Jump option Alpha. Little Surprise, stripped of offensive weaponry with no defensive energy shields and clad only in thin armor, was exposed to view as the struts holding the stealth generator rings were severed by nanotech explosive charges that flashed the struts into plasma. The rings also were each cut in four places and rocketed away, clearing space around the frigate. The planet's strategic defense system had to be viewing the sensor data, which showed a client ship was suddenly right there when no object had been a split second before. The SD network AI had to have blinked, and at first assumed it was a sensor glitch, before it got its shit together and accepted the fact that a Theranan frigate had appeared where it should never be. A ship belonging to a client species. A ship that might be in trouble and in desperate need of assistance from their benevolent patrons. Like that was ever going to happen. The frigate was a warship, an uninvited warship without any clearance. Satellites were given authority to fire maser cannons at the intruder, which was not protected by defense shields, and justice suddenly was not there at all. The security AI of the Pentavar Data Archive was having a good day, as days went for a disembodied sapient being trapped in a substrate far below the surface of a remote world. The archive itself was operating nominally.
The director had issued a satisfactory report on the security situation, which was the best that AI could hope for. The director would be in a good mood, for a box of her favorite snack food had entered the chamber, and she should soon be in an especially good mood, as the box of snack cakes also contained an object the security AI had been unable to scan. No one knew what the director did in her private quarters. Even the security AI had no view in there. But there were rumors. Days when the director was in a particularly good mood, and those tended to coincide with deliveries of things that the security AI didn't need to know about. Then, there was the exciting prospect of future budget cuts that would reduce the base personnel headcount. There would be fewer disgusting biologicals hanging around, causing problems and disturbing the proper order of things. Yes, everything was good. All defense systems were operating nominally, having recently completed a maintenance cycle. Everything was in its proper place, including the Theranin frigate that appeared out of nowhere and just a faint flare of gamma radiation hovering in the center of the underground chamber that was just large enough to hold the little ship. Everything was... Wait, what the fuck? How did a starship get into... Webs, Chen snapped her fingers for emphasis. Light 'em up. Surprise had been stripped of offensive weapons. No missiles, no directed energy cannons. But a defense can also score points. The frigate still had an array of point defense systems, and those autocannons lit off at once the instant they received a reliable targeting sensor feed from Skippy. The chamber had formidable anti-personnel weaponry ranged all around the chamber. Those weapons were no match for the PDS cannons of a starship. The view on the main display was entirely synthetic, provided by Skippy, since the ship's own sensors were blinded. Energy beams and shrapnel flying around the chamber instantly filled the space with a cloud of plasma, and the booster motors that kept Surprise from falling ass first into the bottom of the chamber.